tackling climate change at the same time.
And I just have to ask, even given these alternatives that you're talking about and the ways that people come together in reaction to crisis, is there any way that we will be able to keep climate emissions to 1.5 degrees increase without dismantling the military-industrial complex?
I don't think so. And it's not just the military-industrial complex. I think it's a whole response to climate change that depends on things like market mechanisms. A lot of what we've been hearing about Paris, those who say it was a positive agreement, is that it sends the right signal to the markets. The idea being that if we use market signals, what investors make, then that will lead to the kind of actions we need to take. But there's very little evidence that is happening, and it's certainly not happening on the scale and the speed that we need. The day after Paris Agreement, India said it was still going to double its coal production, so not much of a market signal to them. So I really think it will require much more radical action. We've actually got really about 5 years to turn this around, and it's going to need much more. It's going to need much more dramatic intervention. And the U.S. did this actually back in the Second World War. Roosevelt pulled all the car manufacturers together and said to them, within 6 months, I want you to stop producing cars and start producing tanks. And within about 9 months, they had turned around an entire economy. And that was a crisis of national emergency at that time. We've got something which is now a global emergency. And yet we don't see that same willpower. We somehow think that signals by the market will actually lead to the kind of changes we need. And that's just not the case.
And on that note, we're going to have to cut it short. I've been speaking with Nick Buxton. He's the co-editor of the new book, The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Shaping a Climate-Changed World. He's also the communications manager for the Transnational Institute. Nick, thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio and Heartbeat Silent Sound Systems proudly presents Silent Nights 2015, a silent disco and silent auction benefit for KBOO, December 19th, 8 p.m. at Manifestation PDX. This very special silent disco features talented KBOO DJs and MCs. You'll have three channels of danceable jams to choose from, including bluegrass, the Grateful Dead, reggae, afrobeat, world music, hip-hop, funk and soul, electronic dance music, bhangra, and global bass music. There's something for everyone. We'll also feature a silent auction with art from local artists as well. Silent Nights will be on Saturday, December 19th from 8 p.m. to midnight at Manifestation PDX, 2020 Southeast Bush Street in Portland. For more information on the lineup and tickets and more, go to kboo.fm/silentnights2015. That's Silent Nights 2015, a benefit for our community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of MAMI, an art exhibit at Yale Union in Portland. MAMI is a group show that considers the mystery and chaos of motherhood, and in reaction to the sentimentality and laments the culturally constructed binary of, quote, family versus career, while acknowledging the persistence of that obstacle in the lives of artists. Again, that's MAMI, showing Thursday through Sunday, 3 to 6 p.m. until December 20th at Yale Union, located at 800 Southeast 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This is KBOO Portland.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Cutie Pock Talk, where we invite you to sit down and listen to what's shaping our queer and trans community of color out here in Portland. I'm Darian Jones. I'm a Portland transplant that's been here for about 14 years. You know, I think I'm finally getting acclimated to the climate out here. So that's who I am. And today I just want to send out a thank you message of support to everyone out there, because we at Cutie Pock Talk, we're really appreciative of everyone that supports KABU by listening to the show, because without you all, the show would not be possible. So thank you very much. And today we've got a special guest with us. It's actually one of the co-directors from PFLAG Portland Black Chapter, Khalil Edwards. So, welcome to the show, Khalil.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for actually being with us here today, because I know we've tried to get you on the show here in the past, but it's kind of been like a little challenge because you're such a busy person. You're like a little bee going everywhere. So yeah, can you exactly tell us who you are and what exactly you do at PFLAG?
So my name is Khalil Edwards, and I am the co-director for PFLAG Portland Black Chapter. We recently are in the process, or have shifted to co-directorship with me and my coworker. And I help to lead the organization, and I think the work that that I kind of cover in that is a lot of different things, so it's not the easiest to explain, but I think that helping to lead some of our different programming work and a lot of our kind of internal structure stuff and administrative pieces of the work of the organization, and also working a lot with the work we do with our partners and in coalition, and work around some of the advocacy work that we do in addition to some of our other programming.
So when you say you're in this co-director model, who is your co-director?
Layla Hofstein is the co-director as well.
I think she was interviewed on here one time in the
past. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So can you tell us if, like, we wanted to get involved with PFLAG, what's a good avenue for people to do that? Like, what does that kind of work in the community look like that you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I think if folks want to get involved, they should reach out to us through email or through phone or through Facebook are the best ways to do that. And I can share that information at some point if that's good and helpful. There's a lot of different ways for folks to get involved. We have different committees that folks can be engaged in helping our work. There's lots of different volunteer opportunities as well for folks to really support the organization and be connected with, as well as supporting with donations and small contributions. Also, just by, you know, showing up and helping to spread the awareness of the work that we're doing, and to talk about who we are, and to also be involved and engaged in our events and activities. So just by showing up and coming out and helping us be successful and carry out the work that we do.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Does that work entail a lot of aspects that portray specifically to youth out here in Portland? Do you have like a youth-focused kind of group as part of PFLAG, or what does that look like?
Yeah, so we kind of carry out our mission through a few different key program areas. We have our faith outreach program. We have our Portland Black Pride program. We have our member support program. We have our policy and advocacy program. And we have our youth outreach program. And the youth outreach program takes on a few different aspects. Part of that work is our Q2Q drop-in space where youth can come to Matt Dishman, and there is weekly programming that happens there, and that is really exciting. That's expanding out to two more sites through Portland Parks and Recreation.
And where is Matt Dishman?
Matt Dishman is on Knott Street in northeast Portland.
Okay.
And there's that programming that's happening, and then we just are starting a youth and family night that's going to be happening, I believe, monthly. It's another space for youth to come and bring other loved ones. So it's not just a specifically youth space, but folks can bring their parents or other relatives or family members for a youth and family night with fun and games and different activities that will happen through that piece as well. And then also through our youth outreach program, we do a lot of GSA, QSA support. So supporting gay straight alliances and queer straight alliances throughout the Portland area, predominantly where black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and queer youth are at in different schools and within organizations, and as well as doing some direct support with the youth that we serve, and also a lot of trainings and workshops with schools and administrations and faculty to really ensure that we have safe and welcoming schools and systems for our youth in the community.
That's a lot of actual programming that you all have there. That's phenomenal.
And I forgot one.
Yeah.
We also have our mini grant program.
Oh yeah.
Where youth groups, LGBTQ youth groups, can apply for small mini grants to do basically whatever they want to do with those funds, and it's an opportunity for youth to do some different activities that they want to carry out as part of their involvement with their GSA or QSA or whatever their LGBTQ youth group is.
Wow, that's great. I wish I had had that kind of resource when I was a wee youngling. Well, awesome. Wow, thank you for actually providing us with all of those resources for people to actually learn more about it. Is there a website or where we can get in contact with you?
Yes. So pflagpdx.org. So it's pflagpdx.org. And also email is good. So it's pflagpflagpdx.pbc@gmail.com. And then our Facebook is pflag. Portland Black Chapter. And we also have a Portland Black Pride Facebook as well. So there's a few different ways for folks to find us and get involved and get connected to who we are. And of course, you can also give us a call at 503-232-7676.
Oh, wow. I think you actually have a Twitter account too, don't you?
We do.
It's like PFLAG PBC .PBC Twitter handle.
I think that's it. I'm not a Twitter person, yeah, but we have that.
Seems like you got a lot of avenues for people to get contacted. Well, we'll be right back with a few more questions for Khalil here after this beat.
Go!
I want somebody who can take it apart. Stitch me back together, make me into who I want to be. But all you ever do is sit in the dark. Chasing time.
chance when you double and dip the game. Then scream, make you scream. Hit your hands up and tell them to get the vein. And reminiscing can bring it back to the cabin in Michigan. But man, this the plan. Say goodbye to your lover, cause it's the end.
In the moonlight, I feel like spending my nights alone.
A boss, your constant delay. These are the kind of thoughts I've been having for 3 days. Feel like you're more of a homie. Please, you don't even know me. You think I'm starting new relations. I'm just departing, need my space and time to myself, ventilation. No time for you, I lack the patience. And you like, girl, how you do that? My attitude is weak, but you already knew that. And since we can't get along, I think we should both move on.
Go!
Cause I'm born a dancing the moonlight.
Welcome back to Cutie Pock Talk, where we've got Khalil Edwards here with us, one of the co-directors of PFLAG Portland Black Chapter. Say hello, Khalil.
Hey. Happy to be here.
Good, good. We're happy that you're here. I guess to kind of pick back up in this interview, you mentioned some stuff that's going to be, mentioning some things that might be coming up for PFLAG in 2016. Would you be able to talk about some of those priorities, maybe bills that you're working on and what?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the really exciting things about 2016 for us is that we are expanding. We currently a really small staffed organization with two staff, and so in 2016 we'll be expanding to four staff, which is really exciting and gonna really help us to have more capacity to do all the amazing work that we are looking forward to for the serving Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer folks in the Portland area, in the queer community. And some other work that we are, looking forward to is the Racial Equity Report Card is happening on January 14th. And so we are looking forward to going to Salem to be a part of that legislative day to drop those report cards off to legislators and talk about, it's a really intentional day to talk about race and what that looks like for the state of Oregon and what that looks like in policy and bills and laws that are passed, and have a kind of really frank conversation with folks that are able to make decisions around that and able to make decisions that either hurt or help families and folks in communities of color across the state. So we're looking forward to being a part of that work in the new year, as well as involved in the raising the minimum wage, which we know is a huge issue across the country. Yeah. And as well here in Oregon, and an opportunity for folks to be able to, just put food on the table and take care of themselves. And so we want to continue the work as being a supporter on that campaign, as well as we are part of the Fair Shot Coalition. which is around economic justice and looks at issues that are impacted by the economic security for folks in different ways. And so I want to continue to be work in coalition around the Fair Shot work. I think some of that is the kind of some of the legislative things that we're involved in, and you know, as things come up, we definitely want to stay connected to that. And in addition to that, we are, as I said, we're expanding our youth programming and looking forward to planning a really huge celebration for Portland Black Pride in 2016, the summer of 2016, as well as doing, you know, just really like growing and strengthening our organization. So doing some of that kind of internal work. So we're going to be launching a new website and going to be expanding our resources. We're going to be putting more energy into our faith work, our faith outreach program, and looking forward to some events and some ways that we can continue to support Black faith leaders that are doing the work to ensure that we have safe and affirming and welcoming faith houses for folks in the Black community to come and worship. And so continuing that work as well.
That sounds like a huge amount of stuff on the plate for 2016. Would you be able to kind of maybe tell us some things that we could do as a community to support that work that PFLAG is going to be doing? What does that really look like from a supporter base? Like, how can we be supportive?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, always donations are good. So, you know, if you're able to do that, and, you know, it doesn't take much to have a huge impact. So really, you know, really appreciate and want
to. Oregonians give. Oregonians give.
Yes. And so really want to invite folks and give folks the opportunity to support in that way. And sometimes that's easier for folks to do than to be able to have the opportunity or be able to have the time and space to volunteer. But definitely volunteering is another huge way that folks can help out. And we have a really great volunteer base. And so, you know, folks continue to be involved in that way. And there's so many different opportunities for folks to volunteer and different ways, whether it's doing, you know, some one-time things that they just help out with here and there, or whether it's being actually a part of some of the different committees that we have. We have our faith committee, our Black Pride committee, our events committees. So being involved in those ways too is kind of more of a long-term engagement on a volunteer level. But all those different ways are really good ways to get involved with our work and like us, like our page on Facebook. That's helping right there, because it helps to kind of build up our base and our and the visibility and awareness of who we are and the work that we are doing.
Well, that's good. That sounds like a lot of avenues for people to actually get involved and engage in the community. Yeah, because it's weird, because it's PFLAG isn't that old, is it?
No, we'll be seven. We'll be seven. So that's exciting. You know, we haven't been around a long, long time, but we, you know, it's a really important organization and really important space to have and hold, just to be able to create safe space for our community and to create space for dialogue around these issues around sexual orientation and gender identity and what that means as being a part of this community and folks in the Black community. And, you know, there is not has not been a Black, specifically Black LGBT organization. And so, you know, it's really important and vital that we are here to be that and to continue to do that work, because we know that that's super needed. It's very important. It's critical for folks in our community, whether you are someone that is a part of the LGBTQ community or whether you are someone that is connected to the LGBT community, either by a friend or family or loved one. So there's space for everyone to be involved in our organization. And, you know, whether you are someone that specifically identifies as Black and LGBTQ, or whether you identify as someone that is a supporter, an ally, or a friend and family member of someone that is directly involved or connected to that community. So we really welcome and invite everyone and want to continue to, you know, create that space for people to come together in that way so we can start to, you know, change some of these systems that we know are in place that are, you know, preventing folks from being able to just live their full, true and authentic lives. And so that's the work that we're trying to do. We know it's challenging work, but it's hugely important and critical work. And we are going into year 7 and need to be around for many years to come. And, you know, that'll happen by folks continuing to stay engaged and involved with who we are and believing in our mission and our work and staying connected with us.
Yeah, no, that's wow, that's a lot. I just know from being someone that has actually done work with PFLAG in the past, I can kind of recognize the impact that it has on like every level of community. So I just want to say I am thankful that you and the entire team of PFLAG actually continues to do stuff out in the community, because it's not often that we have any sort of resources out here, especially as Black LGBTQ people. And so, yeah, thank you for doing all that work. Speaking of that as well, too, is there any community updates you want to tell us about, maybe some events that are happening or news of things that are going on in Portland right now?
Well, there's some different events happening. There's no events that we're actually putting on any upcoming events, as the year is kind of ending out, but we definitely support a lot of the different community events that are happening that are more geared towards, our community and towards Black LGBTQ folks. And so really want to encourage folks to stay connected to our website and our Facebook page. And also, by going to our website, folks can add themselves to our newsletter so they can get those updates when we send out our e-blast of just what's happening in the community. Because a lot of times, you know, folks will tell us that, you know, they had a hard time finding community until they found us and were able to get connected. And whether they found community with the work that we were doing or specific events that we had or learning about events that they didn't know were happening that we were able to kind of bring to them and share with them. And so there's lots of different community events that do happen and are happening that I hope folks can get tuned into and get plugged into, and hopefully we can help folks with that. And for us, we have some stuff coming up in February that folks should really stay tuned for that we are excited to be doing. And there'll be more news for that and kind of more details for that coming up. We're looking to do a film screening and a Brown Brunch coming up in the new year, as well as some other ways for folks to connect with community and connect with our work, as well as we have our monthly social time, monthly meeting and social that happens the third Saturday of each month at In Other Words Bookstore. And so that'll be the third Saturday of January. So folks should mark their calendar for that and come to that and come meet folks and socialize and get connected in that way. But other community updates or things to share is just like, as we're ending this year and trying to go into 2016 strong, we have a end of year fundraiser that we are doing. And so if folks can participate in that and help us reach our goal for the end of the year so we can really start out 2016 really strong going into year 7 of this work, would be really helpful and really important.
Yeah, just before we end that, I just want to, you mentioned something about a Brown Brunch in February that's coming up. What exactly is a Brown Brunch?
So it's basically folks for, opportunity for folks to come together and, a potluck for folks to just socialize and network and share in food together and break bread together. And so it's for LGBTQ people of color to just come together to share food, basically. And so different folks host it throughout the year, and we're excited to host it in February. And so we'll be the host for the February Brown Brunch, but it happens throughout the year. And It's just the kind of informal space that for LGBTQ people of color to continue to build community with each other.
Awesome. That sounds like a great, great time. So I'll be sure to add it to my calendar once I subscribe to your newsletter again, which I think I can do on your Facebook now. Is that possible?
I think so.
Oh, awesome. Well, good news. Well, thank you so much, Khalil, for being on the show today. I know you've offered us a lot of resources for people to stay connected and actually support the Black LGBTQ community out here in Portland. So thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Awesome. And so we're going to take another break here, and I'll leave you all to tune in to this new track I just found. It's pretty sweet and mellow. And welcome back to Cutie Pock Talk, where we just had a nice interview with Khalil Edwards, who is one of the co-directors of PFLAG Portland Black Chapter, which is one of the pretty much the only LGBTQ Black specific community nonprofit out here in the Northwest. And so we just got a lot of great insights from them about what we can do to support that community out here in Portland. And I'd like to kind of get ready to sign off for the show today. So, you know, again, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there that support each and every episode of Cutie Pock Talk, because it's not often that we have a space out here to talk about our queer and trans community, especially our community of color in Portland. So again, my name is Darian Jones, and I'm going to be ending the show with a sweet melody from Sylvester, and it's kind of how you make me feel. But yeah, I'd like to invite you all to tune back in January, where we'll have a few surprises for you all about the show, and you'll see what happens. So enjoy the rest of this winter season as we fade off into the new year. Yeah, have a good one.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 5:32. Coming up next, Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law & Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Catherine Franke about her new book, Wedlocked: The Perils of Marriage Equality.
As she says, be careful what you wish for.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
While the movement for marriage equality by the LGBT rights community has been a leading civil rights issue of the 21st century, it's not the first movement seeking the right to marry. Slaves who were freed in the 1860s also organized for, and ultimately won, that right to marry at the end of the Civil War. As Professor Catherine Franke argues in her new book, Wedlocked: The Perils of Marriage Equality, tying the definition of free and equal citizenship so intimately to the institution of marriage presents its own set of problems. In Wedlocked, Professor Franke meticulously compares firsthand accounts of African American struggle for freedom and civil rights with lessons for today's marriage equality movement. This association offers two lessons. First, be careful what you wish for, as the backlash against new rights holders may set back the larger cause for equality. And second, the two movements for marriage rights may help expose the differences between racism and homophobia. Catherine Franke is the Isidore and Seville Sulzbacher Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, where she directs the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. She is among the nation's leading scholars in the area of feminism, sexuality, and race, and is the chairperson of the board of directors at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Catherine Franke, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's so nice to be with you again.
Congratulations on Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality. It's a wonderful book. We wanted to start by asking, what is it about marriage that's made it a suitable vehicle for elevating the civil status of gay people? And why hasn't marriage played the same role for African Americans in this country?
Well, that's the central question of the book. It's a complicated question with a complicated answer. I have to say that it's something that has surprised me in writing this book, that marriage has been such a successful vehicle for rebranding homosexuality. And as I say in the book, marriage has been a way for gay people to take the sex out of homosexuality and for us to be rendered less perverse and more decent people. I never thought that was our goal when I first came out, not a few steps from here at Stonewall and in the Village in the 1970s. But part of why I think marriage has been so successful as a campaign in the courts and in the hearts and minds of Americans is that it's basically a very conservative thing to ask for. Gay people are not interested, or same-sex couples are not interested in blowing up the institution of marriage, which was certainly our feminist project years ago. We regarded it as a sexist, elitist institution that was about rendering women property and preserving male property. But that's not the critique of marriage now at all within the gay community. Indeed, marriage is seen as a way to preserve the security and the normality of same-sex couples. And we've persuaded, or the marriage campaign, I believe, has persuaded the courts and the public more generally that this is the time and that same-sex couples are deserving of that kind of dignity. And so this is the register of the same-sex marriage movement, is that marriage dignifies deserving couples. And unfortunately, the negative consequences of that is that it leaves a kind of remainder, if you will, a kind of leftover of undignified families and undignified couples and people who perhaps are deserving of social shame and that are thus not entitled to the blessings of marriage. And unfortunately, in this country, that remains largely people of color.
The subtitle of Wedlocked is How African Americans and Gays Mistakenly Thought the Right to Marry Would Set Them Free. Let's talk about that, because you really have some poignant stories about African Americans during the Civil War and right after. Of course, they weren't legal subjects then, so they had no rights whatsoever, including the right to marry, but they got that, and it turned out to be kind of a mixed blessing, and I wanted to ask you about that. I had a vision of you sitting in some dusty library basement somewhere in the South coming up with these records, and that's really one of the great parts of the book, and I wanted to ask you about these disappointments.
Well, Michael, it's funny you mentioned that. I could have included in the book some pictures I have of myself on the courthouse steps in Vicksburg, Mississippi, with a young man who was a Civil War reenactment performer in his wool Confederate uniform. So the Civil War, in a way, is still alive and well in some parts of the South.
Especially Vicksburg.
Well, yeah, it certainly is. But what I found there were boxes and boxes in the attic of the old courthouse in Vicksburg of criminal cases where African-American people were prosecuted for bigamy or adultery. And I went to find those boxes because I was curious what marriage meant for newly freed people at the end of the Civil War. I thought there might be some lessons for same-sex couples today about what it means to use marriage or turn to marriage as a vehicle for equality and citizenship. And it turns out there are quite a few important lessons that I got from those cases.
Catherine, specifically talking about slaves, what did they hope would come from marriage? Was it a mainstreaming?
No, not at all. You know, enslaved people are not humans, they're property. And so as property, they were unable to legally marry. You know, a chair can't marry a table. in the same way that enslaved people can't marry. It's an offensive concept, of course, because the institution of slavery is highly, highly offensive. So when black people were freed, they became human, legally human, and thus entitled to marry for the first time. And so the ability to turn to law and exercise rights was hugely important for people who had been treated so horribly for so long. And marriage was particularly important because of a desire to secure their families. When black people were enslaved, of course, they would marry practically. They would marry in front of God, in front of their community, but they were not legally married. And as a result, their owners would sell away their spouse, their children. And they may get married several times in their communities and have several husbands or wives. And at the end of the war, those complicated families sought to find one another and reconstitute themselves. And so the institution of marriage was hugely important for people to feel that they had some family security that they never had had before. And we hear that echo today. Not that, of course, gay people were worried about being treated the way that slaves were. I don't want to at all say that those things are the same. But that marriage provides security, financial and legal security for our families today is part of what's motivated the marriage equality movement, just as it did the turn to marriage in the 19th century for black people.
But let's pick up again on a thought you just expressed about the lessons that one might draw from the experience of African-American people subsequent to the war, once they were freed and could marry. What kind of lessons did you tease out of all of that?
Well, there were many. There were many. So the first, I would say, is that many freed people believed that the freedom to marry meant they can organize their lives however they wanted. They could pick a spouse. Perhaps they could pick more than one spouse. As I said, their families were very complicated. Many people loved more than one spouse and had children with more than one spouse. And so they thought, let's put together more collective families than just one husband and one wife. They learned quite quickly that that was not allowed, that marriage had rules, and you had to comply with those rules if you wanted to exercise the right to marry. And the punishment for that was rather severe. So when people didn't follow the rules of marriage, mostly black men found themselves prosecuted for bigamy or adultery very quickly after the end of the war. And both those crimes were felonies, so of course that would disenfranchise them. They would lose a right to vote. They would go to prison and then became subject to an emerging convict leasing system where white planters turned to prisoners, black prisoners, to do the agricultural work that enslaved people had done before. Being a leased convict to do farm or labor work was more dangerous and more deadly for black men than was doing labor, agricultural work under slavery. So the parallel or the lesson I learned for that today is that over many, many years in the gay community, we've had complicated family and kinship arrangements. We didn't always pick just one person to love or one person to have sex with or one person to raise a family with. We would do so in complicated kinship relationships. That's part of what we celebrated in the gay community. And we're losing that to some degree. We're losing a more creative and open way of thinking family and taking up the nuclear family instead.
You alluded to this in the beginning, but I'd like to hear more about why progressive queers are ambivalent about marriage.
Well, I think we all know that the institution of marriage is irresistible for many people, not only for the romance of the idea of being married or the acceptance that your family may give you once you marry your partner, but also for the legal and economic benefits that marriage brings with it. And so as people of my generation in our 50s and moving into our 60s are looking at estate planning, are looking at our retirement, are looking at how we're going to support ourselves when we get older, marriage becomes a pretty important way of creating security among the couple, but also to inherit Social Security benefits and to think about who will inherit your property when you die. So if you're unmarried and you leave your property, whether it's a house you own together or your savings, to someone to whom you're not married, it's as if you're giving it to a stranger. And it gets taxed at a very high rate. If you're married, you can pass those assets to your spouse tax-free. So it is irresistible. But what I've offered to readers in this book, at the end of the book, is a progressive call to action for married queers. So this is an 8-point plan for those of you out there who sort of held your nose and succumbed to your lawyer or your accountant or other people in your life who said you're really crazy if you don't get married because you're financially and legally vulnerable if you don't, how do you hold on to your politics and still get married? Because I have to say, my partner and I are the only people in our social circle who've been together for a few years, we've been together 10, who have not married. All of our friends have married and have done so somewhat ambivalently, I have to say, but they felt like it was irresponsible not to. And I think, you know, I don't want to judge their decisions, just as I hope they won't judge ours. So this 8-point plan gives you political objectives that you can stay true to. Like, don't collaborate in the repeal of domestic partner benefit programs. Keep defending them. We ought to have a range of ways that people can organize their private lives, their family lives, including marriage, but certainly other kinds of family forms. I just want to jump to the last one that relates to something I said a moment ago about complex families. Last week, I got an email from a friend inviting me to contribute financially to the retirement of a longtime friend of ours who has been a devoted political activist for her entire life. She has no retirement, and she's aging, and hopefully at some point might retire, although knowing her, she may go to her grave doing political work. And this friend is inviting us to contribute to her retirement. I'm not in love with her. She's not my family. But she's part of my political family and my larger sense of kinship. So I made a substantial gift to her retirement. And I think that the idea of marriage and the tax advantages that come with it create this idea of preferred family and then people that have become invisible to you. And I'd like us to keep the spirit in the gay community, but also in the progressive straight community, that we all need to take care of each other, not just our spouses.
I'm curious about your students, Catherine, and do you discuss this topic with them? What are their thoughts?
I have actually assigned one chapter of the book to my students last year in my gender justice classes. I gave them the first chapter on Kentucky and what happened in Kentucky when President Lincoln was trying to conscript black soldiers into the Union Army. And the students read the chapter, and it's mostly told through the voices of formerly enslaved black men and black women, and it testifies to the outrageous violence that these men and women experienced from slave owners when they left the plantations, the men to join the army and the women to join their husbands. And the first thing the students said to me was, I wish you had issued a trigger warning before you had us read this. Now, I'm not a big fan of trigger warnings, but that's a subject for another show, and I'm happy to come back and talk to you about it.
We had that show, actually, last month.
Well, then I'd ask your listeners to go back and listen to that show. But the students, first of all, I think are woefully uneducated about the history of the Civil War and about emancipation and what happened at the immediate end of the Civil War. And I also think that the marriage equality movement today is largely decontextualized from other social justice movements today, let alone in the past. So connecting the dots between gay rights and other civil rights, particularly for African Americans today, is part of what I'm trying to do in this book, and to show that marriage has a racial history in general, but also in particular with the kinds of arguments that have been made in the marriage equality cases, unfortunately, I think, have had the effect of reinforcing racism and particularly the disadvantage of single parents in the black community.
What did you find wrong with the logic that got us to the rights of gay marriage?
Well, one thing I want to clarify for your listeners and more generally is that I don't oppose the marriage equality in general. I think it is wrong for the state to exclude same-sex couples from marrying, and the reason I think it is wrong is because they hate us. It's a form of state-sponsored homophobia, and we should just call it that. We should call it out just as other policies like limiting the vote is a form of state-sponsored racism. And limiting reproductive rights is a form of state-sponsored sexism. So part of what I found problematic about the way in which the marriage equality cases have been argued is that we made a turn to dignity. And dignity was the lead argument that the advocates made in the Supreme Court, largely because they were appealing to Justice Kennedy. As you know, almost any civil rights or important case these days that's argued before the Supreme Court is really only argued to one person, and that's Justice Kennedy. He brings a kind of liturgical or religious fervor to the idea of gay rights that has delivered in the gay rights cases, but done so in a way that I think is somewhat dangerous. So rather than declaring that excluding same-sex couples from the institution of marriage is a form of heterosexist hatred against gay people, instead we won the case because Justice Kennedy said that not allowing us to marry humiliates us. And humiliates children because their families should be dignified like other families, and that the blessings of marriage are something that should be conferred upon those couples that deserve it. So that same-sex couples are now deserving of the dignity of marriage, thereby kind of leaving on the table that others are not. And so what the marriage equality movement has turned into is a marriage rights movement rather than a sexual rights movement or a gay rights movement. And if we look at a case that advocates often point to, the Loving versus Virginia decision, where the Supreme Court found that laws that prohibit white people from marrying people of another race are unconstitutional, the court there said that what's wrong with those laws is that they embody white supremacy. White supremacy. I mean, that is an incredibly powerful political term that the Supreme Court had never used before and has never used again. And I think our challenge could have been to get the court to use the word homophobia and hatred of gay people in this case, in the marriage equality cases today, just like they did in Loving versus Virginia, rather than turning to dignity, as we did in appealing to Justice Kennedy.
And Catherine, is there a movement to sort of bring forth these issues, or are you in the minority of thinking?
Well, I regretfully am in the minority, but it's a substantial minority. There remain many of us within the LGBT community, but not only. There are plenty of progressive allies more broadly who still have a critique of the institution of marriage and worry about the way in which we've invested and indeed kind of rehabilitated marriage through the marriage equality movement today. So there are plenty of us who have a much broader agenda in mind, who are concerned about those who can't or won't marry, and also are worried about the way in which we distribute important essential social benefits through marriage. I mean, one should be able to get health care, one should be able to get Social Security, one should be able to have some level of well-being, regardless of who you're married to. And part of what we do with marriage is distribute benefits because we don't have a social safety net in this country. And that more progressive economic justice or welfare critique of the way that we order society here is absent from that marriage equality debate.
Catherine, you write that gays, in your words, have been able to escape the curse of Sodom, but blacks have not been able to escape the curse of Ham. What are those two curses, and why is that so?
Well, these are biblical references. I'm not a scholar of the Bible, but I felt that these two were ones that made sense here. And they're references to biblical texts or parables in the Bible that basically explain the badge of inferiority that black people and that gay people bear in history and today. So this notion that African-American people bear a badge of inferiority is something that we've heard in the civil rights movement and in litigation to address racism in this country, and that law can play an important role in removing that badge, that it's not something essential about blackness, it's not something that attaches necessarily to skin color or phenotype, but that it's actually a social stigma that's created through a history of racism and racist laws certainly reinforcing that history. Unfortunately, the badge of inferiority, the stain, as I call it, of inferiority that black people continue to live with has been much more difficult to remove than the stain or the badge of inferiority that gay people have been burdened with. That we are perverts, that we are sinners, that we are disgusting has certainly been a story dating back to Leviticus, certainly, or earlier, that gay people have heard, and indeed that the Supreme Court embraced not that long ago in the Bowers versus Hardwick decision that was decided in 1986. In those short years since 1986 to now, we have lifted that badge, that stain, that sense of homosexuality as being a shameful, disgusting kind of set of practices that ought to be criminalized and rendered as an illness, really. And marriage, I think, has played an important role in lifting or even rebranding homosexuality. Yet marriage remains an institution that is publicly perceived as a site of failure for African Americans. Even though all of the evidence shows that there is great health in African American families, there's enormous resilience in African American families. Children are well loved by their fathers and their mothers and their grandmothers and their aunts in African
families. Exactly. Are rich there.
We still perceive that as a failure rather than a success. And to the extent that there are statistically fewer women, African-American women who have children while married to their children's fathers, we don't attribute that largely to the crime of mass incarceration in this country. Instead, we cite dysfunction or even pathology in the black community. So there's been little, I think, that African-Americans have been able to do to impress public policymakers and the public more generally that marriage and the family is a site of African-American strength and survivorship. Yet gay people have been able to do that so quickly. And that's part of what the book tries to unpack, is why has marriage been such a successful rebranding mechanism for gay people, yet remains a site of failure and discipline.
You were amazed at the speed, so was I, truly amazed. And you call it a juggernaut. How do you explain it?
Well, it's something in which the larger society has an investment. I think many heterosexual people were starting to feel somewhat guilty that they were getting married and their same-sex couple friends were not. And so they saw themselves as having an investment in this campaign so that they, too, could get married without guilt. The campaigns were very well financed, largely because this is a very conservative demand. As I said earlier in the interview, gay people are not looking to blow up the institution of marriage. They're asking to comply with it and be disciplined by it and to participate in it fully. So in part, I think it's the conservative nature of it and the degree to which the gay community has been able to portray veterans, stamp collectors, people taking their kids to soccer games, just decent, regular old Americans who want to get married and just happen to be gay. Right. Unfortunately, most of those plaintiffs have been white. Not all of them, in fact, are, and I want to credit the ACLU and Lambda for actually assembling a pretty diverse group of people to represent this issue. But the media has not picked up on that diversity. And so the same-sex marriage movement has had a kind of racial endowment by the perception of it being a white movement that I think has helped it. And I think we in the gay community have an obligation to counter that misperception of who's in the gay community and who are the couples who want to get married.
Yeah, I remember when Mayor Bloomberg presided over the wedding of the head of the city council. A friend of mine who had been active in was the head of the Gay Activist Alliance back in 1969. And he saw that and he just shrieked and he said, "It's the wedding cake crowd."
Right. Well, we're calling it the wedding industrial complex at this point. And, you know, many states are advocating and advocates, too, that allowing same-sex marriage is going to be an economic boon for states that are going to now be hosting destination weddings and... I mean, think of the new people who are getting married who weren't before. I have a critique of that, too, but I do think there is an economic payoff for this.
We've been talking to attorney and professor and head of the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Catherine Franke, about her new book, Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality. Catherine, the book has just come out. I imagine there's going to be some launches here in New York City. Where could people go to celebrate with you this wonderful book?
Well, on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, the 18th, we'll be doing a panel up at Columbia at 4:30 in the afternoon with leading scholars of both gay rights and black civil rights, Patricia Williams, Mignon Moore, and Kendall Thomas. And I will be on a panel discussing the issues in the book. Everyone is welcome. We'd love to see you there.
Again, the book's called Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality, How African Americans and Gays Mistakenly Thought the Right to Marry Would Set Them Free. It's a wonderful book. We recommend it to everybody. We thank you, Catherine Franke, for being on Law and Disorder.
Many thanks, Catherine.
Well, thank you, Michael and Heidi. It's great to be with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From now through December 15th, Fire on the Mountain on 57th and Northeast Fremont, Los Gorditos at 12th and Southeast Division, Mike's Drive-In in Selwood, The Cup and Saucer on Northeast Killingsworth, and the Old Salt Supper House on Northeast 42nd Avenue will collect clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves, and the folks at Zippity News will distribute them to local shelters. Dropbox locations and more information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Everybody, welcome to another edition of Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we tackle